The Years of Lyndon Johnson, The Path to Power, by Robert A. Caro, Part 1, Continued. Nor did Johnson confine his compliments to the written word. Dropping in to chat with Ethel Davis, the 40-year-old assistant registrar, he would tell her how much he loved and respected his mother. Then he would tell Miss Davis that she reminded him of his mother. Or he would ask her advice on some matter. When she replied, he would tell her, she recalls, that what I said was like what his mother had said. I was sort of flattered. When dealing with members of the administration and faculty in person, in fact, Johnson displayed an admiration so profound that fellow students say that if they described it fully, no one would believe it. If, for example, a professor held an informal bull session on the quadrangle, and Johnson was attending, he could be found sitting at the professor's feet. Yes, literally sitting at his feet, a classmate says. If the professor was sitting on a bench, students might be standing around him or sitting next to him, but one student, Lyndon Johnson, would often be sitting on the ground, his face turned up to the teacher, an expression of the deepest interest and respect on his face. He would just drink up what they were saying, sit at their knees and drink it up, and they would pour out their hearts to him. Many students doubted the sincerity behind the compliments and the admiration, because they noticed no matter what the professor was saying, Johnson would never disagree. That was what got me, says Joe Berry, who, having succeeded Ardis Hopper as president of the student council, was often involved in quadrangle discussions about campus issues. He never took a strong position. You never knew where Lyndon stood. Says another student leader, Milton Kennedy, he would never disagree with anything a faculty member would propose. Having enough knowledge of how the professor felt, he would make a statement he knew the faculty member would agree with. Says a third, Vernon Whiteside, I have heard Lyndon agree enthusiastically with one point of view that a professor was saying, and the very next day, if another professor was giving the opposite point of view, I have heard Lyndon agreeing with that point of view, just as enthusiastically. As for Lyndon's front-page panegyric on Dr. Evans's unfailing cheerfulness and geniality, Evans's secretary, Tom Nichols, had reservations about the editorial's sincerity. The president would frequently unleash a fearsome temper on subordinates, and Johnson could tell when a storm was brewing. At first sign of worsening weather, he would find a hasty excuse to get away, and he wouldn't come back until he had ascertained that Evans had left, usually by sticking his head in the front door of the outer office and whispering to Nichols, "Has he gone yet?" The reaction of the targets of this barrage of compliments is documentation of the adage that where flattery is concerned, no excess is possible. Miss Brogdon, so inflexible about her curfew rules, relaxed them for Lyndon Johnson. The professor at whose feet Johnson sat most often was H.M. Green, a history professor and debate coach. Johnson may have received a D in the debate course taught by another professor, but he made Green's debating team, much to the surprise of students who, like one member of the team, considered him very forceful but really not a good speaker at all. The key to Johnson's college career, the key, in fact, to whether he would be able to earn enough money so that he could have a college career, was Prexy Evans. The public flattery was nothing to the private flattery, witnessed only by Tom Nichols, that went on in the president's office. And flattery, a striking humbleness, deference, obsequiousness, was not the only weapon employed. Nichols, a non-competitive man, liked Johnson. Nichols was red of face, a real country boy whom Lyndon could easily get around, another professor says. But he couldn't resist remarking on the pains the student took, not only to carry out Evans's assignments diligently, but to dramatize his diligence. Equipping himself with a large notepad, he listed his assignments on it, and, when reporting back to Evans, held it up where Evans could not fail to see it. I have seen him standing at the president's elbow holding a written list of the items to which he had devoted himself, calling these off and checking with his pencil as the signal that each had been completed, Nichols says. He began to make his own assignments, looking eagerly for them, Nichols says, to make the favorable impression which he was determined to create, and would include these on the list, telling Evans of each chore, and then placing next to it a big, bold check mark. And the impression he wanted to make was the impression he made. Evans mentioned Johnson's efficiency several times in his short talks at the weekly General Assembly in Old Main's second-floor auditorium. He began to listen to Johnson's suggestions on student job assignments. "He got next to Prexy, and he got me promoted to Inspector of Buildings at $25 a month," his roommate Booty Johnson says. Prexy even fell in with a scheme to help Lyndon pay his tuition. "About that time," Lyndon Johnson would recall, "I couldn't get tuition from any other source." He also needed money for food. He asked Evans to allow him and his roommate, who were already living rent-free above his garage, to earn money by painting the garage. Evans not only agreed, but allowed them wages of 40 cents per hour. "That was a craftsman's wages," Johnson would recall. Other students got 20 cents per hour for similar work. And when one painting did not give Johnson enough money to stay in school, Evans told him to paint the garage again. And again. According to some students, the garage was painted 4 times that term. Once or twice, Evans even took Johnson with him to Austin. Evans's references to Johnson in his assembly talks created an impression on campus that the student was close to the president, and the student fostered that impression. When asked where he lived, he replied, "At the president's house." He was only the president's office boy, and to dramatize the difference in status between him and Nichols, his desk had been placed outside the railing in the president's waiting room, not inside it like Nichols's. But Johnson made the position of his desk work for him, jumping up and greeting everyone who came into the office, and doing so in such an expansive manner that, Nichols says, some of them probably thought he was running the place, smooth as silk. Decades later, a woman student would remember how Johnson opened a swinging gate to admit me to President Evans's office for an interview which led to my first job. Leaving the office to deliver messages from the president, he made a production out of it. A pencil would be tucked behind an ear, a huge sheaf of papers would be clutched in one hand, and he would always be in a hurry, bursting out of the office and rushing down the halls of Old Main or along the dirt paths to another building, with a long gangling stride, his arms swinging vigorously, if awkwardly, out from his sides, too busy to stop and talk. A busy man, on the president's work. No one knew that Johnson's sole responsibility on his occasional trips to Austin with Evans was to report to Evans on what one legislative committee was doing if the president was tied up before another committee. Johnson talked at every opportunity about how Prexy and I worked together in Austin to obtain funds for the college. At every opportunity, moreover, he would try to be seen in public with Evans, and in public he acted so differently from the way he did in private that Nichols was astounded by the contrast with the humble, obsequious Lyndon of the office. Introducing the president to his friends, chatting and laughing ostentatiously with him, even once patting him on the back, the campus buzzed about that for days, he created an impression of familiarity. Many faculty members believed he had a far more important job than was actually the case. And Johnson never took advantage of this belief, never listened to faculty members with less deference than before. He still sat at their knees and drank in everything they had to say. And, Whiteside says, boy, you could see they loved it. His popularity with the faculty did not, however, carry over to the students. Milton Kennedy, who echoes Whiteside's vivid description of Johnson sitting at his instructor's knees and drinking in avidly all they had to say, pauses and finally says, words won't come to describe how Lyndon acted toward the faculty, how kowtowing he was, how suckassing he was, how brown-nosing he was. And if students disliked Lyndon Johnson because of his attitude toward the faculty, they disliked him even more because of his attitude toward them. If he was obsequious to those above him, he was overbearing to those who were not. He had come to San Marcos with the same tendency to talk big that he had displayed in Johnson City. And if, when he first arrived at college, he had had little to talk big about, he made maximum use of what he did have. he would introduce himself as Lyndon Johnson from Johnson City, leaving the impression that he was a member of the town's founding family. If he was asked directly whether he was, he would confirm that impression, saying that Johnson City had been founded by his grandfather, a statement that was, of course, not true. One of the first editorials he wrote for the Star made a point of mentioning "my heritage of Southern blood." In a later editorial, he made a point of expressing admiration for Jefferson Davis. Now he had more to talk big about, and he talked bigger. And he wouldn't let anyone else talk. The young man, so eager to sit and listen to the faculty, seemed determined that everyone else was going to sit and listen to him. Fellow students who ate at Mrs. Gates's boarding house remember two things about Lyndon Johnson most vividly. How he grabbed for food and gulped it down and grabbed for more, trying always to get more than his share. He had those long arms, and he would reach out with that fork and get the last biscuit on the plate, even if it was on the other end of the table, and if there was one pork chop that was bigger than the others, no one was going to get it but Lyndon Johnson, says one of those students. And how he also grabbed more than his share of the conversation. Says another of Mrs. Gates's boarders, Horace Richards, he was a very good talker. He would tell these stories about his father, and about Jim Ferguson, and about all the things that had happened in Austin. And he was a great imitator. He would imitate these Germans from around Fredericksburg with their accents, and he was very entertaining sometimes, particularly to some of these country boys who really didn't talk very much. But if someone else tried to talk, well, he just wouldn't let them. He'd just interrupt you. My God, his voice would just ride over you until you stopped. He monopolized the conversation from the time he came in to the time he left. I can still see him reaching and talking, reaching and talking. The dislike of Lyndon Johnson had a particularly sharp edge, moreover, because of a certain lack of accuracy in his conversation. The students didn't know of all the inaccuracies. He told the men at the table that he had an IQ of 145, and they never found out that that was not the case. His actual intelligence quotient has been lost in time, but the two faculty members in charge of administering the tests during the time he was at San Marcos both say it was not outstanding. He told them he had high marks. Years later, most of them would still be under the impression that he was, in the words of one, a brilliant student, absolutely brilliant, straight A's, which also wasn't the case. His overall average was B-. He frequently remarked that he had taken 40 courses and gotten 35 A's. He actually took 56 regular classroom courses and received 8 A's. He had made the college debating squad, not the first team, as he would ever after maintain, but one of three alternating teams. And shortly after he arrived at San Marcos, it was announced that debaters would be awarded school letters, as were athletes. At Mrs. Gates's table, Lyndon let it be known that he had persuaded Dr. Evans to make this decision. His auditors, who did not know that the decision had actually been made before he arrived in San Marcos, were greatly impressed. If students didn't know about these inaccuracies, however, they knew about many others. Johnson's debating partner was Elmer Graham, an older student, back in college after teaching 4 years to make enough money to continue. Graham did most of the preparation for the team. I was studying to be a minister, and I had been preaching at country churches, so I was used to organizing material. And most of the debating, too. He would generally lead off with the primary argument, and then, after Lyndon had given the first rebuttal, Graham would give the final rebuttal. But he didn't mind that, and admired Lyndon's instinct for the jugular. Lyndon's debating was more clever than profound. The one thing I can honestly say about Lyndon is that he had a knack of finding a weak point in the other team's argument and coming back at it pretty good. He was fond of Lyndon, until he started hearing the reports of the debates with which his partner was regaling diners at Mrs. Gates's. "It was a little bit irritating," Reverend Graham recalls. "I would hear that he had said all these things that were so devastating. Well, he hadn't said them at all. Either I had said them, or no one had said them. Lyndon liked Lyndon, no doubt about that. He bragged quite a bit about the debating." The exaggerations in Johnson's political stories were also sometimes revealed. As a result, some of Mrs. Gates's boarders agreed with one who said, "I just didn't believe that he was as much on the inside of big decisions in Austin as he claimed." They were ready to laugh when Whiteside one day related what had been said when he pressed Lyndon about his father, whom he was continually depicting as a member of the state's highest political councils. "What does your father do?" "Well, he works for Jim Ferguson." "Oh, what's he do?" "Well, he's the bus inspector." He talked a lot about girls, too. His brother, Sam Houston Johnson, recalls that more than once, when he visited his brother at San Marcos, Lyndon, coming back into the room naked after a shower, would take his penis in his hand and say, "Well, I've got to take old Jumbo here and give him some exercise. I wonder who I'll fuck tonight." He devoted to his appearance an amount of time, and considering his financial situation, money, inordinate even for a college man. He was continually experimenting with new styles for his black wavy hair, which he considered his most attractive feature. Parting it in the middle or on the side, slicking it flat with stay comb, or working, endlessly it seemed, to his roommates, to get it pompadoured just right. Despite the expense, he was frequently at the barber shop for 40-cent haircuts and 25-cent shaves. "He was very hard to shave," says the barber. "He had that very tender white skin." Worried that his neck was too long and thin, he would practice scrunching it down between his shoulders. Practice endlessly, a roommate recalls. Before a date, he would spend quite a long time dressing. He'd stand in front of the mirror and comb his hair and dress and get everything just right when he was going out, Booty says. Then he would scrunch down his neck and head out for the evening's encounter. These preparations, combined with his continual vivid boasting about his sexual successes, gave him a reputation as a ladies' man, except among those students who were ladies' men. On a campus where women outnumbered men 3-1, it was very easy for most men to get a date. But among the social clique on campus, it was known that getting one was not always easy for Lyndon Johnson. Miss Brogdon would, as a matter of course, grant him privileges, an extended curfew, permission to drive to Austin. She only grudgingly granted to other students, so couples wanted to double-date with him, but they often had difficulty finding a fourth. His pretty cousin Margaret, who was dating Booty, got him a blind date with her roommate, and with Booty borrowing a car, the four got to go to a movie in New Braunfels, a considerable treat. Margaret and Booty were looking forward to other trips, but the roommate refused to go out with Lyndon again. His unpopularity with women students would not have aroused particular comment on campus, had it not been for the zealousness with which he tried to retouch reality. "I mean, we all boasted and bragged about girls," says one man. But Lyndon's boasting and bragging were to an extent that was ridiculous. Nobody believed him. To some of his fellow students, in fact, it began to seem unwise to believe Lyndon Johnson on any subject. In their opinion, he seemed almost unable to tell unvarnished truth about even the most innocuous subject. Some of them took to asking him questions just so they could laugh at his answers. "Once I was sitting next to him in class, and I saw him wearing a new tie and socks," Horace Richards recalls. "I knew where he had bought them, but I asked him where he had bought them. He said, 'I got them over at Scarborough's in Austin. I paid $1 for the socks and $1 for the tie.'" Scarborough's was the fanciest store in Austin, and $1 was a whole lot of money in those days. "I said, 'Lyndon, you're just lying. You were never in Scarborough's yesterday. Besides, I saw them in Woolworth's window yesterday. The socks were 10 cents and the tie was 20 cents.' But Lyndon just had to lie and say he was wearing a $1 tie. It just seemed like he had to lie about everything. He had made a great point of describing himself as a tough man in a fistfight, something believable despite his awkwardness, because of his size. During a poker game, however, he began arguing with another student and wouldn't stop shouting at him. The other boy jumped up and lunged at him. Johnson, without a single gesture of resistance, immediately fell back on a bed and, as his foe approached, began kicking his feet in the air with a frantic windmilling motion. The other poker players all remember him lying there and kicking, like a girl, Horace Richards says, and they remember him shouting, "If you hit me, I'll kick you! If you hit me, I'll kick you!" The other men were astonished. Says Whiteside, one of those present, "He was a coward. You know every kid in the state of Texas had fights then, but he wouldn't fight. He was an absolute physical coward. And the thing about it was that he had made such a big thing about what a great fighter he was." But the aspect of Lyndon Johnson's character most remarkable to other students was his lack of embarrassment when caught out in an exaggeration or an outright falsehood. "You could catch him in a lie about something, and it was like he didn't care," Richards says. "The next day he'd be back lying about the same thing again." Says Clayton Stribling, "He never seemed to resent being found out. He just didn't care. He wouldn't get mad. He'd be back the next day talking the same as ever." The biggest men on campus were the athletes. They had formed a secret organization called the Black Stars, which met in the big meadow on Barney Knispel's farm for drinking parties, at which these burly farm boys consumed beer by the kegful, frequently vomiting it out on the grass, and held initiation ceremonies, a highlight of which was convincing a blindfolded initiate that he was kissing a bull's penis, which was actually the bent elbow of the group's president, who was called the Jupiter. The Black Stars won most of the class offices. They hung around together at the Bobcat, the little shack at the bottom of College Hill run by the Chorus Brothers, former football stars themselves, and partied together with the college's prettiest girls. "Everyone wanted to be part of that crowd," recalls Ella Sorella. "That was the in crowd." Lyndon Johnson wanted very badly to be part of that crowd, and his roommate wanted him to be. Alfred T. Johnson had been born and reared on a lonely ranch in the empty wastes of West Texas, and had thought he was doomed to that life. Until one day, at tiny Lytle High School, someone put a football in his hands. One of the most famous players in Texas high school football history had been a great halfback named Booty Johnson, and on that day at Lytle, as the shy, rangy ranch boy began to run with the ball, someone yelled in awe, "Look at old Booty Johnson go!" Word of his ability spread, and one day a coach from Southwest Texas State Teachers College showed up and offered him the San Marcos version of a scholarship, a job sweeping out campus buildings, and he took it. "My dad worked hard all his life, and I'd worked hard all my life," he would say. "If I could get me an education, I could let my brain work for me instead of my hands." The Southwest Texas Bobcats were a tough team. "After bulldogging steers all our lives, you think it was tough tackling a guy?" Clayton Stribling asks. But during practice scrimmages, they had as little success tackling Booty as high school teams had had. A talented athlete, he was a star baseball and basketball as well as football player. He was elected captain. In an age in which, even at faraway San Marcos, football players were lionized, he was the campus hero. Under his picture in the pedagogue is the caption, "The Stalwart Booty Johnson." But it is not the remembrance of his athletic ability that, 50 years later, makes San Marcos students smile when they remember the stalwart Booty Johnson. He was the fatherly type, a football player says. If things were going bad in a game, he'd call a timeout and gather the team around and say, "Now look, fellas, we're here to play football," and settle everybody down. He didn't settle down only football players. "You always felt you could go to him with your problems," says one woman. "He was a very kind person, gruff and tough, but very kind. He was just like a father to everybody." His unselfishness was legendary, not just on the football field, where, because the other halfback, Lyons McCall, a good runner, was a poor blocker, Booty volunteered to do most of the blocking while McCall carried the ball. If the team was behind in the last minutes of a game, however, the players would growl, "Give it to Booty." Booty was the kind of guy who, if you woke him up in the middle of the night and told him your car had broken down, He would get out of bed and walk 5 miles to help you. Nothing was too much trouble for him, Vernon Whiteside says. And he was always so soft-spoken and slow-talking and friendly. No campus activity was complete unless Booty was part of it. He played the lead in romantic comedies and sang the solo in Sweet Adeline with the campus barbershop quartet. Old Booty, Ella Sorella would say, 50 years later, smiling and crying a little at the same time. Gruff old Booty, a sweeter, calmer human being I never met. And, she adds, a more complete contrast with Lyndon could not be found. You would see them walking around campus together, Lyndon talking, 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 swinging those arms, and Booty so calm and sweet. You just could not imagine how two boys so different could be friends. But friends they were, so close that the campus, seeing them so often together, called them Johnson and Johnson. Slow-talking Booty admired Lyndon's glibness. He had a wonderful way about him, he recalls. Once Lyndon and myself were sitting there on the campus, after Lyndon had gotten himself a pipe, and Dean Speck came by, and he said, "Lyndon, you know we don't allow any smoking on campus." "I'm not smoking, Dean Speck." "Well, Lyndon, you've got your pipe in your mouth." "Yes, Dean Speck, I've got my shoes on my feet, but I'm not walking." I nearly died laughing, and Dean Speck did too, and he said something like, "Good boy," and went on walking. Well, I could never have thought of saying something like that. Shy Booty admired Lyndon's effusiveness. "He was so warm and affectionate," he says. "The first time I brought him home, he grabbed my mother and hugged and kissed her, and my sisters, my father said, 'That boy you brought down here, I thought he was going to kiss me.'" And fatherly Booty was touched by something he saw in the skinny boy, 3 years younger than himself. Before dates, he would lend Lyndon money, money he had earned in his campus jobs, and would tie his bow tie. And then, when Lyndon was ready to leave, he would dance around Booty, jabbing at him with his fists. "He'd make like he was going to fight, punch you and all," Booty says, still smiling at the memory. Just as the fatherly older boy who had been Lyndon Johnson's best friend in Johnson City, Ben Crider, had helped him, so Booty tried to help him. He asked the Black Stars to make Lyndon a member. Because of the respect in which Booty was held, when one Black Star was asked who was the Jupiter, he replied in a tone of surprise that anyone would have to ask, "Why, Booty, of course." They would normally have admitted anyone he sponsored, even a student who wasn't an athlete. But not when the student was Lyndon Johnson. Lyndon acted differently toward the athletes than he did toward less renowned students, but they saw through his attitude. "If he thought you could help him, he would fawn all over you," star end Joe Barry says. "If you couldn't, he wouldn't waste much time with you." In later years, Lyndon would maintain that a single black ball, cast by a student whose girlfriend Lyndon had stolen, had kept him out of the organization, but the truth was otherwise. Black stars who were present remember seeing the slips of paper on which the votes on Lyndon Johnson's nomination had been cast, and seeing, on one slip after another, the same word, "No." At the Black Stars' next meeting, Booty brought Lyndon's name up again, this time with arguments uncharacteristic of Booty. The Black Stars guarded the secrecy of their organization with the exaggerated seriousness of college boys. Booty said that he had inadvertently left the organization's constitution, bylaws, and membership list out on his dresser, and that his roommate had seen them, and that he should be admitted so that he would be bound by the Black Stars' oath of secrecy. "We figured Lyndon had thought of that business," one Black Star says. "That wasn't Booty's style at all. Booty would never have said a thing like that on his own." Whoever the author of the strategy, it did not succeed. The second vote on Lyndon Johnson was the same as the first. No, no, no. Ella Sorella could see how hurt he was. "He wanted so badly to belong to the in crowd," she says. "He would have loved to be part of that crowd, to be accepted by them. But they wouldn't let him in. He was just not accepted. You had the feeling of climbing and climbing, and then he didn't make it. You see, he was just one of the mass, and he so badly wanted to be more. To tell the truth, I felt very sorry for him." Her reaction to Lyndon Johnson was more charitable than that of most students, however. A more common feeling was that expressed by a group of his classmates who frequently visited the little summer lodge on the Blanco River in nearby Wimberley that was owned by Ethel Davis, the assistant registrar. Fond of Lyndon, who had told her that she reminded him of his mother, she invited him along. "The youngsters would go fishing and swimming," she says, "but I don't remember Lyndon fishing or swimming. He just talked all the time. He told funny stories." The youngsters, however, were less amused. Everybody else was always anxious for the meal to be served, but he was never ready to eat. They often said, "Of course Lyndon's not ready to eat. He has to finish telling his story." And he embroidered the stories. I found them interesting, but the boys didn't care to have Lyndon there. They asked Miss Davis not to invite him back. Even Ellis O'Rella has to admit, he was not a popular boy. The feelings about Lyndon Johnson spilled over into print. Each edition of the San Marcos yearbook, The Pedagogue, contained a section, The Cat's Claw, which mocked students' foibles. In the 1928 Pedagogue, 12 students were selected for such treatment. The treatment of 11 is rather gentle, but the 12th was Lyndon Johnson. Instead of a picture of Johnson, the editors used a picture of a jackass. The caption beside it read, "As he looks to us on the campus every day." Johnson, the caption went on, "is from far away, and we sincerely trust he is going back." And the caption said, "He is a member of the Sophistry Club, master of the gentle art of spoofing the general public." The Pedagogue was not the only publication in which the word master was applied to Lyndon Johnson. In the College Star's humor column appears the following definition. Bull, Greek philosophy in which Lyndon Johnson has an M.B. degree. "Master of bullshit, that's what M.B. means," says one of Lyndon Johnson's classmates, Henry Kyle. He was known as the biggest liar on the campus. In private, when there were no girls around, we called him Bullshit Johnson. He was given the public nickname Bull. "When you saw him, that's what you called him," says Horace Richards. "Hiya, Bull. How you doing, Bull?" Bull Johnson was his name, as far as we were concerned. "That was what we called him to his face," Edward Pools, another classmate, says. "That was what he was generally called, because of this constant braggadocio, because he was so full of bullshit, manure, that people just didn't believe him, because he was a man who just could not tell the truth." Chapter 9. The Rich Man's Daughter. In Johnson City, Lyndon Johnson had courted Kitty Clyde Ross, the daughter of the richest man in town. In San Marcos, the richest man was A.L. Davis. Lyndon Johnson began courting Davis's daughter. Carol Davis, 2 years older than Lyndon, had graduated the year before he arrived in San Marcos, but although she was not unattractive, a tall, sandy-haired, slender young lady, she was painfully shy and had never had a serious suitor. Johnson, meeting her early in 1928, became her first, and when she responded to his interest, the only young lady in San Marcos who had done so, he made sure the news got out. The couple was conspicuous anyway, because Carol's father had bought her a big white convertible, and Lyndon, who would drive it when they were together, would honk its horn loud and long when signaling for curb service at Hillman's Confectionery in town, or when passing students trudging up College Hill. In the words of one student, Lyndon made a production of the romance, a production whose primary theme was not the usual college boy boasting about his sexual progress with Carol, although there was plenty of such boasting, but Carol's car and Carol's willingness to pick up checks. "He'd brag about this," a student says. "He'd say, 'We've been to the movies in Austin and Carol paid,' and about the fact that Carol's family had enough money so that she could do so." So incessantly did he harp on this last point that there was a general feeling that the basis of the romance was, in the words of another student, the fact that she was a rich man's daughter, and Lyndon was always looking for a way to help himself. Says yet another student, "He was hinting he wanted to find a girl who had a lot of money." So unconcealed was his desire to marry for money, in fact, that it was to become the subject of a joke in the pedagogue. If this was his intention, however, it was to be thwarted in San Marcos, as it had been thwarted in Johnson City, and for the same reason. Carol's father had become one of the hill country's few successful businessmen, building a small grocery in Dripping Springs into the Southern Grocery Company of San Marcos, a wholesale house so big that it purchased baking powder by the freight car load. A large, friendly man who had designed his home so that he could greet passers-by from his porch as he sat there every evening, he possessed not only unshakable physical courage. In a Ku Klux Klan parade held in San Marcos at the height of the Klan's power, virtually every prominent local family participated, except the Davises. He had defiantly announced that no member of my family will be with them. But convictions to match. A.L. Davis, says a friend, was a man who made up his own mind. And once he had made it up, I don't know that anything could ever change it. And among the firmest of his convictions, along with his fierce Baptist faith, was his loathing of men who drank, of politicians, particularly liberal politicians, whom he considered leeches living off the taxes paid by hard-working businessmen. He had served as mayor of San Marcos, but only because the townspeople, during the years in which the town's streets were being paved, had begged him to take the job to ensure that the paving was done right. He had done so by marching daily behind the paving machines. As soon as the job was completed, he resigned. And of the impoverished farmers and ranchers of the hill country, whose poverty, he was convinced, was due to loose morals and laziness. San Marcos, situated on the very edge of the hill country, on the first line of hills above the plain, was served by two railroads and was more prosperous than other hill country towns, with 5,000 inhabitants and several streets of large, gracious homes. Sam Johnson, of course, qualified on all three counts, and on a fourth. He was a Johnson, a member of that shiftless, no-account clan for which Davis had long had contempt. Davis's most precious possessions, moreover, were his four daughters. He lavished dresses and automobiles on them. He had a grand piano shipped in from St. Louis so that they could learn to play. He was fiercely possessive about them and very much afraid they would marry beneath them. Having dreamed one night that his eldest daughter, Ethel, the college's assistant registrar, had married the owner of a local ice cream parlor, he woke up in a rage at the man, which, Ethel recalls, lasted for months, although she and the man were barely acquainted. Davis had, in fact, moved from Dripping Springs because he was afraid his girls would marry those goat herders up there. Wanting them to be educated women, he sent them to boarding schools, but none was a particularly good student except Carol, his youngest and his favorite. When she graduated from college with high marks, he was very proud. Like the father of Kitty Clyde Ross back in Johnson City, he had no intention of allowing his jewel to fall into unworthy hands. Papa did not want Carol to marry Sam Johnson's son, and that was that, Ethel says. When he realized that Carol was serious about Lyndon, he told her, "I don't want you getting mixed up with those people. That's the reason I moved away from the hill country. I wanted better for my children." Lyndon tried to overcome this prejudice, but Davis, whose eyes could glitter coldly behind his gold-rimmed spectacles when he was angry, was not charmed by the approach Lyndon was using so successfully on his professors. "Lyndon was pretty determined to get on his good side," recalls Ethel, and tried to chat with him on his porch, but Davis, after one or two conversations, would leave the porch when his daughter's suitor arrived. "My father always sat on the porch and talked to people," Carol says, "but he wouldn't talk to Lyndon." For a while, nonetheless, the romance flowered. In May of 1928, Carol visited Johnson City on two consecutive weekends, staying with a college friend. While she says that she and Lyndon did not have much in common, she liked to play the piano and sing, but Lyndon didn't like to listen. "I loved the picture shows, but Lyndon didn't care much about them. Lyndon was just interested in politics, which I didn't believe women should get mixed up in." She also says that we were very interested in one another. On a picnic with a group of Johnson City friends, Lyndon and Carol went off alone, hugging and kissing. But Carol was a very devoted daughter. "I knew I couldn't go against my father's wishes," she says. She had told Lyndon how strongly my father felt about him, and it was always hanging over us. All the time we were going together it was hanging over us, the whole time. During that summer, chaperoned by an uncle, she went to the Democratic National Convention in Houston, to which Lyndon had wangled tickets as a representative of the college newspaper. He was tremendously enthusiastic about the convention, but I just remember how hot it was and how long those sessions lasted into the night, more boresome than anything. Whether or not her father's opposition was the real reason for these feelings, she began to wonder, she says, whether two people with so little in common ought to marry. In September, she would be leaving San Marcos to become a schoolteacher in the little South Texas town of Pearsall, and she was almost looking forward to the chance to get away and think. At about this same period, the summer of 1928, Johnson's money troubles were growing worse, and no longer from a simple lack of cash. Ben Crider's $81 was not the only gift Johnson received during his first year and a half in San Marcos. Several relatives, including his aunt Lucy Johnson Price, who on one occasion called him aside and handed him all her laboriously saved egg money, $30, gave him cash presents. And he also received loans. The Blanco State Bank advanced him $75. The deans who administered the student loan fund were, perhaps because of his closeness to President Evans, unprecedentedly liberal with him. By the time he graduated, he would owe the fund $220. His monthly salaries, $15 as Evans' assistant, $30 as star summer editor, were among the highest paid to students, and of course Evans allowed him to earn additional money by painting and repainting his garage at craftsman's wages. If students, many students, were attending Southwest Texas State Teachers College for $400 a year, including rent, which Johnson, of course, did not have to pay, Johnson should have been able to afford to stay in college. But he spent more than most students, on 40-cent haircuts, on clothes they considered extravagant, and, before he began going with Carol Davis, on dates. Although they were none too frequent, each one was a production. Whether show-offing at Hillman's Confectionery or in Austin, he spent money on girls as if such expenditures could give him popularity. Whatever he made or borrowed, he spent. Once, for example, he conceived the idea of selling real silk hose on campus, and, returning from Austin with sample cases well after midnight, walked from boarding house to boarding house, barging into men's rooms, snapping on the lights, and while they were still growling sleepily, "What are you doing, Lyndon?" trying to sell them a pair or two. The next morning, Dr. Evans, legendarily close-fisted with his money, agreed to buy so many pairs from Johnson, 13 dozen was the figure the president sheepishly told Dean Noly, that he was still wearing them years later. Lyndon earned more than $40 from that 24 hours' work, and promptly spent it all in another 24, in a spree on which he took another student as his guest in San Antonio. This book is continued on cassette number 7, side 1.